Jermaine Alfonso, give me a name.
John Lennon.
Welcome to Give Me a Name, where a guest presents me, Ben Kirschenbaum, with a dead historical figure they find interesting, and we discuss. If you haven't already, go ahead and listen to part one. We jumped around a bit, but we're now roughly up to November 7th, 1966, when John meets the woman who would become his second wife.
I was saying to somebody the other day, there's only two artists I've ever worked with for more than one night stand, as it were. That's Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono. I think that's a pretty damn good choice.
All right, so that brings us to Yoko Ono.
All right.
Here we go.
Here we go. Yeah.
All right.
Give me a name, Yoko Ono.
Yes. So, a little bit about her background, I guess?
Sure, yeah.
Born in Japan.
Yes. I think she's from a Japanese family. I think they moved to Scarsdale, maybe, at some point, and then she moved after them, like, near Sarah Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so she grew up in Japan and I think spent some time in New York. And yeah, basically a conceptual artist, very innovative in her own field, sort of was overlooked as an artist, but was very smart about publicity and very intent on making a name for herself. And I think pretty early on, there's some story about her trying to maybe get with Paul or get in touch with Paul and that sort of not working out. And then she tries with John Lennon. And so she ends up inviting him to one of her exhibitions. And then when he gets there, she sort of says she doesn't really know who he is or didn't really, you know, I think in retrospect, it was like, I didn't even know who John Lennon was. Kind of one of those people. But like,
no way.
She certainly knew who John Lennon was, but yeah. You know, I don't know why she feels the need. Maybe she didn't want to seem like she married for fame or, you know, was chasing after him. But I think there was a little bit of a design that she had on him.
And they don't start actually, they're not together right away. They have like a correspondence.
Yes. At first, he's sort of intrigued by her. He said he saw her art and was impressed by it. He liked that it was a little bit more, like I think there was like a magnifying glass on a ladder and he went up the ladder and looked through the magnifying glass and it said yes. And he liked that. He thought that, you know, most avant-garde art was negative and this was positive. And so he was, you know, that appealed to him.
Most of the avant-garde artists of that period were all negative, you know, like break a piano with an axe. It was mainly male. I'm looking at the female here. It was mainly male art, and it was all destructive and, you know. But here was this little crazy message on the ceiling. And then the guy introduced me to her, and she didn't know who the hell I was. She had no idea. She was living in a different environment altogether. The gallery owner was all fussing around. He was thinking, is he going to buy something? And she's not. She's ignoring me, you know. Mm. So he introduced us, and I said, well, where's the event? You know, where's the happening? Because I'd seen the bag. So she just takes a card out and gives it to me and just says, breathe. So I said, you mean that? She said, you got it. I said, uh-huh, all right, I'm beginning to catch on here. You know?
And that kind of goes back to the Paul John thing, right? Of Paul being a bit of the positive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes. I didn't think about that.
So maybe in terms of partners, he's looking at a little bit of...
Maybe she offsets him a little bit. But interestingly enough, I feel like she is a little bit more similar to him in some ways than Cynthia is. Mm-hmm. You know, like she's very artistic. She's kind of got this rebellious streak about her. She's married at this point and has already had a kid.
Right.
Too.
And there was a custody battle with her first kid.
Right. That hasn't happened, I don't think, yet.
Okay.
But I think she's still married to this guy, something Cox. And when she's starting this pursuit of John Lennon. Yeah. I mean, she's just a very different personality type than Cynthia Lennon. Cynthia Lennon was very sweet. She was maybe a little too accommodating to John, I would say. John was, you know, on tour caught up in this Beatlemania whirlwind. So she was sort of left alone a lot with Julian at home while John was on tour. John was very loving towards her, you know. In later years, John would go back through, once John gets with Yoko, he goes back through and talks a lot about how he never really loved Cynthia. You look at some of his lyrics, you know, I'm in love for the first time. He's talking about that with Yoko. Very cruel. But from his letters to Cynthia, he loved this person. You know, he loved her a lot. Maybe he only married her at that moment because she was pregnant, but he was very much in love with her, but was growing distant, you know. And Cynthia said that when he started taking drugs, specifically LSD, and she wasn't that into it, and he kept trying to get her to try the LSD with him, she felt like that was a wedge that was being driven between them. He was sort of going off on this new path and was increasingly becoming alienated from her. And he also could be cruel sometimes. You know, famously, he would snap and get very angry and be very verbally cutting. That was just a part of his personality. And he did that with everyone, including her.
And they were together when he meets Yoko.
Yes.
And it takes, I think it was like a year and a half-ish before they actually start an affair.
Yeah. So first, the Beatles go to India. And Cynthia goes with them. Paul is with this actress, Jane Asher, is dating her. And, you know, the Beatles go with their girlfriends and wives. I think John and... Actually, George and Patty are already married. And Ringo's married to Maureen. And so all of the Beatles and their wives and Paul and his girlfriend go. And during this trip, basically a trip to pursue meditation with the Maharishi. And during this trip, Cynthia starts to feel distant from John. Like, he's sort of pushing her away. And she starts to, you know, slowly figure out, oh, he's talking to this Yoko Ono lady. Like, he's getting letters from her sometimes. You know, this is sort of happening. It's this undercurrent that's going on. And she would mention it, like, oh, I didn't know you were talking to her. And John would be very dismissive. Like, oh, she's just that crazy Japanese artist. Like, I don't know anything about her.
Yeah.
Then, at one point, John suggests that Cynthia takes a vacation to Greece. Cynthia goes to Greece, and basically during that trip, while Cynthia's away, John invites Yoko over. They record what becomes this album, Two Virgins. Cynthia comes home and finds them together, basically. They're in robes and just sort of hanging around at home. She's shocked to see, stumble across this scene, you know? And she basically leaves. And even then, there's some back and forth where she comes back and John says, I actually do want to be with you. That was just, you know, didn't mean anything. And then he ends up becoming distant again, and he cuts off Cynthia completely. And Cynthia sort of describes the first time she sees him and Yoko meeting them together. And John is suddenly very humorless. He's very harsh. He looks a little bit skinnier. He's kind of transformed a little bit,
right?
You know, when he's with Yoko.
And John actually went through what he calls his Elvis phase. Just a quick side about his weight. But during that time period we were talking about, where he feels very stressed out and all that stuff, he does gain a little bit of weight.
Yeah, yeah. He calls it his fat Elvis phase. And I believe that a reporter at the time wrote an article where they called him the fat Beatle. And I think that got in his head and you know, people say that he may have had like some sort of an eating disorder afterwards, because he gets super thin. But also, like, George also gets really thin. I think that's also just an effect of some of these drugs that they were taking.
Right,
you know?
Right.
They get really kind of crazy looking.
So John and Yoko, the Ballad of John and Yoko is a single that, well, goes through the sequence of events of them getting married and having difficulty getting married. But they are, till John's death, this, like, seen by the public as this weirdo couple.
Yes, for sure. And it's interesting because, you know, John had been a little bit less prolific writing music at this point. Paul was sort of, you know, taking over the reins a little bit with the Beatles stuff and the leadership and Brian's absence. And, you know, he worked really well with George Martin. So as a studio band, Paul was really starting to become the guy within the band. And, you know, I think John either it was in reaction to this, or maybe he was feeling it separately, started to feel like, I think he's a restless guy. You know, he always was looking for the next transition. And I think Yoko sort of looked down a little bit on rock and roll. Maybe that appealed to John too. You know, everyone in the world is kissing his ass, and here's this woman who kind of is like, I don't think what you're doing is all that great.
Right.
You know, especially after someone whose mother figure was Mimi, who always criticized him, never looked up to what he was doing, what he was interested in, or always kind of shunned his interests. And so, you know, you can get into the psychology of why he went for this Yoko Ono lady, but that seems to maybe play a role. And they were basically joined at the hip. And Yoko, I think at that point, John started seeing himself as wanting to be an artist beyond just a rock and roller.
Which he always has a little bit of. Like, he writes those couple of books.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
In the 60s.
Yeah, he was always, he when he was a kid, he grew up very inspired by Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass. He was a big cartoonist. You know, at one point, his dream was to maybe be a cartoonist. And so he wrote his own books. There's a book called In His Own Right that John wrote that's full of like short comedy. So he was always, I think especially as the Beatles started to get pinned to like who's who, like Paul's the cute one, you know, right. George is the quiet one. John became the smart one. You know, he sort of became the one that was the witty one and he could write and he had a book out and was intelligent. But yeah, so I think there was this aspect of him that was like, what we're doing is not that interesting. Maybe we should go more avant-garde. Maybe we should be, should I be doing more art, be a better, bigger artist than this like rock and roll stuff, and sort of distancing himself from his past work a little bit.
And you do definitely start seeing, but I mean, it's true for Paul's stuff too.
Of course.
Much more experimental. I mean, Strawberry Fields Forever is
yes.
Gotta be yeah. for people listening to it at the time, you know, a surprising piece.
Sure,
Tomorrow
yeah.
Tomorrow Never Knows before that.
Yeah, for fans of the Beatles, you know, the Teeny Boppers, that must have been like a real trip. And I think John was starting to cut himself off from that earlier phase. But it is true, you know, Paul gets this reputation of being the pop guy and John is the worldly experimental guy. But Paul was the one that was initially into avant-garde stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
that was his thing.
That was his thing. He was way interested in that. And the second part of the Beatles' career, when they are more experimental, that's when Paul's at his most prolific, and John's most prolific is the earlier Teeny
yeah, right.
Bopper stuff, which is also great, you know? So I think it's Paul really gets the short end of the stick with
as
that.
As the less sophisticated
yes,
one.
Yes, which is crazy, and it's insane. Especially when you look at the White Album, you know, and the stuff they're putting out there, and, you know, Paul invents heavy metal on the White Album with yeah. Helter Skelter.
Yeah, I mean, Helter Skelter is the first really heavy metal song, or I guess you can consider it the first heavy metal song.
Yeah, sure, I'm sure you go back and there's something else, but it's one of the first mainstream ones.
John on that one's got Happiness is a Warm Gun,
yeah.
which is one of my favorites.
Right. The avant-garde song on that album, obviously, is Revolution 9, which is, you know, a crazy thing to listen to. Paul was very opposed to it because he just thought, even though he liked it, liked avant-garde stuff, he felt like this didn't belong on a Beatles album.
And critics, and even now, however many years later, people agree.
Like, people do agree. I mean, I'm mixed on it. I actually listened to it for the first time in a long time recently. And there was part of me that kind of felt like it's kind of cool for it to exist on the White Album. You know, if it's going to exist in a form, it's cool that it's on this album that is so scattered and through different styles and different things. And it just feels like a pastiche of all the Beatles trying out different things, and I kind of like it there. So that's, but I do understand where people come from with not liking it.
It's basically just, I mean, it's a lot of different things, but it's
yeah.
a guy. Who is it? John saying number nine?
Yes,
number nine?
I think it's number nine a lot, and then there's Conversation and some weird poetry it thrown in, but it's just noise, you know.
Yeah,
it's a lot of noise.
So Yoko and John are inseparable. They have a bed in. During
yes.
their honeymoon?
Yes.
Which is kind of a riff off of, or riff might not, but a sit-in, like the next, you know, type of thing.
Right.
For world peace.
Yeah.
Just sort of generally.
Which is, I never know what to make of all this stuff, because peace It's funny that it was like that was the cause, you know, like that was the controversial cause, it's peace. But obviously during the time of Vietnam, it made a lot of sense and it meant something. But now it just sounds like the most toothless.
Well, it sounds like a Miss Universe type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. World peace, you know, it's such bullshit. But I guess it meant something and that's what they were going for. For them, it was publicity, right? They were just ginning up publicity. John said it's like for any other cause, you know, you gin up company or you do advertising for a product. Well, we're advertising for peace.
Right.
Peace is the product that we care about.
They do the famous naked photos.
Right. So the naked photos were for the Two Virgins album cover. That's that thing they recorded when Cynthia caught them. And that was a big thing for the Beatles because they had this attitude like if John's showing his penis, like it's like we're all showing our penis, you know? This is crazy. You can't do that. And it was very controversial. And the thing about this phase of the Beatles is it's starting to fall apart a little bit.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Like the White Album, John always said it started to become more like, here's John's song, and it's John and the backing band, and here's Paul's song, and it's Paul and the backing band, and here's a Harrison song, you know?
Yeah.
It stopped being like the four-headed monster. They're all working together. It started to become more of their individual contributions and cobble together into an album that roughly fits the Beatles' name. That being said, I think the White Album's incredible, and yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there's to say about it. It's great. A lot of people say it's too long, but they should have cut some of the tracks, but I think it's cool.
I like it. It also is one of the best songs on the album. Maybe the best song is While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah.
So you are around this time. I mean, started a little bit before, but around this time really getting to see George and seeing George blossom as a songwriter.
Totally. And this is some of the pain because the old dynamics still hold where Paul sort of looks at George like a younger brother and is a little bit, you know, bossy over him and John too. You know, they kind of hold supremacy over him. And, you know, for the longest time, George wasn't a great songwriter, nor was that his interest. So now he's interested and he's coming up with really good stuff. And they're just not that excited about all of it. You know, they put on a lot of the good stuff, but some great George songs get pushed aside in favor of Lennon McCartney stuff. And I think George starts taking it very personally, particularly against Paul. Even though John is equally to blame for a lot of this stuff, and John is very dismissive of a lot of John's songs, a lot of George songs. And in fact, sometimes there are examples of times that Paul would sort of help George with music and make it work, and John was nowhere to be found. But I think John just occupied, you know, the little Elvis. He occupied this space where they all looked up to him. So George took it out on Paul and was just unhappy with Paul. And Paul started viewing the Beatles a little bit more like, especially when he wrote a song, like he had a vision. You know, he knew how he wanted it to sound, and he didn't really care about the opinions of other people. And a lot of times he was right. You know, there's some famous stories about George wanting to add like a guitar lick in Hey Jude. And Paul was just like, no, that doesn't work at all. And George got upset. But at the same time, you know, the Beatles worked best initially all together. Like during Revolver, they were all contributing things to the songs. You know, they were all building these songs together. And so I think this is when it starts to, they're really rubbing up against each other in a way that's going to, the friction's really going to start to disintegrate the band.
Yeah. And you see it a lot in the documentary where George and in the first, so the documentary split into three parts. And at the end of the first part, George leaves the band.
Yeah.
There's a disagreement between George and Paul. Again, it's over. It's funny when the Beatles fight.
Yeah.
Because they're very calm. You know, they're not like screaming at each other.
It's very British. It's
very British. Yeah. And but they're disagreeing over a song. And George is really the first one to leave. He does come back and they stay together at that point. But you can see that George's frustrations are a big, big part of what's falling apart, as you said.
Right. And also at this time, John starts bringing Yoko into the studio with them. And they sort of had this unwritten rule beforehand, especially when Brian was around, of like no one else in the studio except for the Beatles. Right. No wives, no girlfriends.
You could be around.
They can be around. You know, Cynthia said they would come at the very end and maybe listen to some tracks early.
Yeah, like a big surprise.
Yeah, and they'd leave, you know. But Yoko was basically, you know, as you see in the Get Back documentary, she was there. She was sitting in.
She's not making any noise. Like, she's not really saying much.
She's not saying much.
At least in the documentary.
In the documentary. But apparently, I think she would make suggestions on things and offer, you know, her input onto songs and kind of would take John's side on a lot of things. And Paul and George were just, you know, not happy with it. They were just like, yeah, I mean, and even the presence of someone, even when they're not talking, it's just a little odd. Why is she there?
Right.
Why does this need to be? And I think in some ways what was happening is John was seeing Paul take over his band and he was starting to sabotage it, you know, subconsciously, consciously, I don't know. And this was one of the ways that he was doing it.
Well, you can quote Paul, you can look at it in the papers. He said many times that first he hated Yoko and then he got to like her. It's too late for me, you know. And for Yoko, you know, why should she take that kind of shit from those people? You know, they're writing about it, looking miserable in Let It Be. You sit through 60 sessions with the most big-headed, uptight people on earth and see what it's fucking like and be insulted by it just because you love someone. That's, and George was insulted her right to her face in Apple office at the beginning, just being straightforward. You know, that game of, well, I'm going to be upfront because this is what I've heard. And Dylan and a few people said you've got a lousy name in New York and you give off bad vibes. That's what George said to her. And we both sat through it. And I didn't hit him. I don't know why. But I was always hoping that they'd come round. I couldn't believe it, you know. And they all sat there with their wives like a fucking jury and judged us.
All right. So let's talk the breakup.
Yeah.
And all these factors definitely play a role.
Huge factors, yeah, all of them.
And it would be completely wrong to just blame it all on Yoko or something like that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what, you know, by the time that John leaves, and John is the one who leaves.
Yes.
Business is what really gets in the way.
Right. So there a few things happened. So it turned out once Brian died, they started to look into some of his dealings, and he was a great manager in terms of getting them to the next level. But when it came to signing deals, he was terrible. Like, he had no experience, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. So they kind of got screwed on a lot of these songwriting deals or things that would have made them a lot of money down the line, royalties, things like that. I think they were trying to figure it all out and they realized that they weren't making as much money as they could have been. So simultaneously, in the wake of Brian's absence, they needed to find a new manager, lawyer, another figure like that to handle their business. And John met this guy, Alan Klein, who used to manage the Rolling Stones. And John really liked him, even though Mick Jagger and a bunch of other people had warned him that this guy's like a con man and a crook.
Yeah.
But John said, you know, if everyone talks bad about someone, he can't be that bad. You know, if this guy is real bad, he can't be that bad.
Okay.
I think it's sort of like the Trump logic a little bit, like what got Trump elected a little bit, you know? It's like someone is such a con man overtly that people almost trust him a little bit, you know? It's like you're going to get screwed either way.
Right, right.
They're going to screw a manager, a politician is going to screw us either way. At least this guy is sort of forthright with it. So he will be better off in his hands, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I think there's like this weird logic sometimes that makes people go with someone that's like an honest con man.
Right, right, right.
You know? But yeah, so John and actually George and Ringo liked Alan Klein. Paul liked Linda Eastman's father. I believe his name is John Eastman. And Linda Eastman ends up being Linda McCartney. This is a photographer that he met and he ends up marrying her. She, you know, they stay married until her death in the late 90s. And yeah, so Paul likes Linda's dad. He likes the Eastmans. Of course, the other Beatles don't like the idea of being managed by Paul's girlfriend's father. So they go with Alan Klein. So it becomes this three against one dynamic. And it sort of sets Paul apart from the other Beatles a little bit. Paul obviously recognizes that this guy's, Alan Klein's a huge con man, is going to screw them over. But for some reason, the other three go with it. And that basically, this conflict, along with all the other things we've talked about, sort of leads to the breakup of the Beatles. I also think that they were suffering from not performing live. You know, I think that even though their in-studio stuff is some of the best stuff they made and was really, really great, I think that they wanted to go back and perform live again. You know, I think they were missing that energy.
And they get a bit of a taste for it. Well, the last time that they performed together live is at the Rooftop.
Yeah.
Illegally.
Yes, famously. Yeah, as you can see in the Get Back documentary.
And a lot of the tracks that they perform up on the roof, including Get Back, that's the version that's on the album Let It Be.
Yeah, exactly. And Let It Be was a very tumultuous project, making that album, getting it together. They were being filmed during it for a movie, which is why we have all that footage. And I think it was just a really difficult period. Not to mention, like, okay, so they wrapped the White Album in October. Right? A double album.
Yeah.
And they're back in the studio in January to make another album. It's like, why didn't they? They should have just taken a break. You know, they needed a break. They needed time apart. They needed to recharge. But I think McCartney, out of just habit and out of just need to do something, and he was driven and pouring out his brain with just amazing songs, got them back together. And I think it was just too much for them. I think they weren't ready for it. I think it just pushed them over the edge.
When they break up, it is the John Paul divide is intense. I mean, they are angry at each other.
They're very angry at each other. And, you know, Paul in a meeting suggests, like, hey, maybe we can all perform live somewhere, and starts to, you know, pitch these things at a meeting. And John's like, you know, you're daft. I'm done. I want a divorce.
Yeah.
I'm done. He walks out. Now, John had quit many times before George had quit. I think there was this feeling of we'll get it back together somehow. And by the way, in the meantime of all this, they, after Let It Be had happened, they shelved the album. They made Abbey Road, which was their last recording.
Right. Abbey Road recorded last, but came out second to last.
Came out second to last. Yeah. And it's an incredible album, you know?
Well, Abbey Road and Let It Be, these two albums that are, when they're hanging on by a thread, are two of the greatest albums ever.
Yes, exactly.
So even with all of this conflict,
they're
able to produce it. And largely because Paul is just so prolific right now.
Paul is really prolific. He pushes them, and George comes in with some moments of greatness. Yeah. John comes in with Come Together.
Yep.
It's just they just fire on all cylinders for that last album. And on the back side, they didn't have any tracks for the back of that album. And George Martin, I think, came up with the idea of, you know, maybe some of your scraps you can go through. And then I think Paul and George Martin, some combo of the two of them, come up with the idea of this long medley that's like a bunch of their short songs
flowing
together. And it's unreal.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just unbelievable.
Which I kind of always wished that Abbey Road came out last, because how cool would it be if that Abbey Road medley ending with the end, then in the end, the love you make is equal to the love you take, or love you take is equal to the love you make.
Yeah.
If that were the final.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think about it that way just because it's the last one they
it
recorded,
is the last one
you
they
know?
Recorded. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just a beautiful album, and it's nice that they were able to get it together for that and work together as hard as it might have been. I mean, a lot of crazy things happened on during the making of that too. At one point, John and Yoko got into a car accident, and at the time, unbeknownst to Cynthia Lennon, Julian was with John, and she didn't even know that they were going on a trip to Scotland, and they got into this car accident and found him. Julian was fine, but then they went back home. And Yoko had, you know, Cynthia was really upset, and she, you know, was demanding to know from John, like, why did you do this without my permission? And all she got back was a message from Yoko saying that Julian was very badly behaved. Yeah. So there's some, you know, Yoko had some cruel moments with Julian, and there's more to come. But after that, they like brought a bed into the studio so Yoko could recuperate while they're recording this music. It was just getting really crazy. And I think everyone was done after this. So John walks out. What ends up happening is I think Paul, in frustration, he goes to the countryside somewhere.
And he's depressed.
He's depressed. And a reporter asks him, are the Beatles getting back together? And just in frustration, he says, no, we're done. And so Paul gets blamed for the breakup. And it causes all of this bad PR on Paul. Paul gets blamed called out as the reason that the Beatles broke up. He broke the Beatles up, the man that destroyed them. Meanwhile, John is jealous because he wanted to be the one to break up the Beatles. So he wanted to be the guy that was known as.
Yeah, because that takes great power.
It does. And he was like, I formed the Beatles. I broke up the Beatles. And he kept repeating this later on, which is true.
Yeah.
Paul, meanwhile, was just sort of like, I just said something. I didn't know.
Yeah, I really wanted it to keep going.
Yeah, Paul, of all people, was really fighting for the band to stay together. And towards the end, George was too. George Harrison wrote a letter that said, a flower on its own is beautiful, but in a garden, it's, I don't know the rest of the quote, better. But better, yeah. I guess. Yeah. Poetic George.
Yeah, it's great.
The garden is better, George Harrison, 1969. So anyways, George really wanted the band to stay together too. And I think that was, George had come from, I think during one of the breaks, from working in America with a lot of American bands and like The Band and Dylan. And he sort of got used to this very egalitarian way of acting as a band, and people coming in and out of the studio. And as you see in the Get Back documentary, he brings in Billy Preston, the pianist that sort of helps out the Beatles put together their music at the very end. And I think in George's mind, what would have happened is the Beatles would have taken breaks. They would have worked on their own solo projects and come back together. And maybe they would have cycled people in and out, and they would have, it wouldn't just be these four guys. But I think Paul and John specifically were sort of like, no, these are the
Beatles. It's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
And I think in retrospect, even though that attitude broke the Beatles up, I think it solidified their place in history a little bit more. It kind of froze them in amber a little bit. As like, this is the Beatles. It's not just, like Fleetwood Mac or the Rolling Stones. Right.
And I got to think also from George's perspective that it's like with John and Paul, there's kind of this condescending attitude.
Yeah.
But to the rest of the world, he's a Beatle. Like, of course. The rest of the world, he's huge.
Yeah,
But in their eyes, he's the kid.
Yes, of course. And, these are all guys in their 20s, too, They're not thinking about it.
Yeah, that's the other thing we got to point out.
Yes.
When they break up, they're in their early 30s, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think John is maybe, like, 29 or something. It's like...
Oh, late 20s. Yeah.
It's crazy,
So that means they've lived this... And even if you see on the Get Back thing, I mean, they kind of look like old men.
They look way older.
Yeah.
All the interviews, you hear them, you hear interviews with George Harrison from like 76 or something, and you see just how young he is, and it's just shocking, like 32 or something, and you're just like, how is it possible? They sound so wise and worn down, and this massive experience is behind them.
So solo careers, all of them, and that includes Ringo, have great solo careers.
Great solo careers, yeah.
In John's first album post Beatles is Plastic Ono Band.
Plastic Ono Band, yeah.
And that has the song God.
God, famous song.
And God is an interesting song because it has him just listing off things that he doesn't believe in.
Yeah.
And he starts off with included in it is a lot of religious things. I don't believe in Jesus.
Yeah.
Buddha,
yeah.
And then it ends with, towards the end, he says, I don't believe in Elvis. I don't believe in Zimmerman. Why he says Zimmerman over Dylan?
He said that Bob Dylan is phony, that he changed his name. So he went with the original name.
So he cut. Yeah, right. Robert Zimmerman is Bob Dylan's actual name.
Right.
So he says, I don't believe in Zimmerman instead of I don't believe in Dylan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it ends with, I don't believe in Beatles.
Yes.
I just believe in me.
So John, at this point, goes through this very intense, sort of like what he did with Cynthia and Julian a little bit. He has this need to burn the past. Maybe it's what happened to him as a child. I don't really know. Some element of his psyche felt the need to, if something bad has happened or something traumatizing, you move past it and you destroy it and you never think about it again. So at this point, he is giving interviews, basically torching the Beatles, everything about the Beatles legacy, he gives this very famous Rolling Stone interview called Lennon Remembers. It's exactly 10 years before his death, December 8th, 1970, that he gives this, you know, you can listen to it on YouTube. It's a, you know, three and a half, 4 hour interview.
I listened to it.
It's unreal.
Yeah.
It's an incredible interview. He's really angry.
He's not in a good place.
He's not in a good place.
When I was about 12, you know, I used to think, I must be a genius, but nobody's noticed. And I thought, well, I'm a genius or I'm mad. Which is it? I say, I can't be mad because nobody's put me away, therefore I'm a genius. I mean, genius is a form of madness, and we're all that way, you know. But I used to be a bit coy about it, like my guitar playing, you know. If there's such a thing as genius, which is just what? What the fuck is it? I am one, you know. And if there isn't, I don't care, you know. But I used to think when I was a kid, you know, writing me poetry and doing me paintings, I didn't become something when the Beatles made it or when you heard about me. I've been like this all my life. Genius is pain too. It's just pain, you know.
He just went through this thing called primal therapy, scream therapy, which I guess I think affected him. You know, on the song The Plastic Ono Band, you hear him talk about mother, you know, there's a song Mother that really explores the pain that was caused by his parents, and he's really in a bad place throughout the recording of that album. Throughout this interview, it's just very dark. He's torching the Beatles. He distances himself from Sgt. Pepper. He derides George Martin. He says George Martin didn't do anything with the Beatles. He torches Paul's solo albums. Paul just released Ram, great album. He's like, this album's terrible. They asked him about All Things Must Pass, another great album. He says, it's a little better than Paul's, but I don't like it either. You know, he's really just, he's insulting everyone. He talks about how the Beatles hated Yoko. They were always insulting
her.
Yeah,
you could just see it or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very intense. Even though I think for the most part, the Beatles were pretty cordial with Yoko, and despite their feelings, I'm sure there were moments that she was made to feel unwelcome, but I think that John, he starts to get really paranoid. You can sort of hear it in his voice. And, you know, it is interesting because at one point in the interview, he does say something like, you know, I'm just a guy. I just shoot off at the mouth and I just say things. I say a lot of bullshit. I don't, you know, he sort of admits that you can't really take him too seriously within the interview. But this interview is very significant because it ends up shaping Beatles history for decades. I think because of this interview, John gets viewed as the real Beatle. He's the, you know, he's the serious Beatle that is deserving of respect. And Paul put out a lot of the bubblegum kind of songs, you know, and John, he's the profound Beatle.
And he's putting down all the early stuff where he's like, you know, oh, that was, I was being a phony.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, totally. He's totally shitting on himself too, and all his old songs. He goes as far as to say, is like, the only time the peak of the Beatles was when we were in Hamburg with Stu Sutcliffe and Pete Best, and by the time we got to the studio, we were dead in the water. It's insane. He's just desperate to torch the Beatles and their legacy and start something new.
Which, who knows? I mean, there are not many recordings of the Hamburg stuff. Maybe
it was great. Maybe Pete Best was
surprisingly.
So yeah, I mean, it's this really definitive moment where he is really lighting the whole thing on fire. And again, because none of the other Beatles really do an interview like that, and then John dies. And his word ends up becoming like gospel.
Right.
And so he gets sainted and he becomes the only Beatle that matters. You know, he's the genius and everyone else was lucky to be there.
And he has a lot of interviews then throughout the 70s. Let's talk a little bit about the 70s. So
yeah.
He, first of all, comes out with a lot of great music. 1971, Imagine.
Imagine.
Which is an unbelievable album. And of course, the title song is, I mean, it says it there at Central Park. I mean, it is probably maybe the most iconic thing he did with or without the Beatles.
Yes. Was it better than Yesterday, though?
No, nothing's better than Yesterday.
What's interesting about Imagine the Imagine the song is obviously very beautiful. It is a song I find hard to listen to for the first time, you know, with fresh ears, because
yes,
it's been so, probably to what John would hate, it's been so commercialized. It's so used so easily at any tragedy, yeah, at anything that ever happened, you know, in commercials. It's just one of those things that
true,
it's
true. But I will say he hates it, but he might also like sure, the aspect sure of it, just in I terms bet of, you know, I mean, the other thing that's was true throughout the 70s, John Paul's getting number one hits.
Ringo's
getting number one
George
hits. And George and John is the last one of the
yes,
four to get
he is
one.
Yes, the last one.
Whatever gets you through the night.
Yeah, it's a big deal for him. I think it really affects him. It definitely affects him wanting to get back with the other Beatles. Because, you know, throughout the 70s, of course, everyone is like, so when are the Beatles getting back together?
Yeah. SNL does the famous thing where yeah, like Lorne Michaels is like, I'm going to pay you guys $1,000.
Right. And at the very beginning, Beatles are in contact because they, all of their business is intermingled because they started that Apple Corp thing. And so they all are, all their business dealings are all connected. So all they're all inextricably tied together and stuck in legal proceedings forever. I think like past John's death even.
Yeah.
And so it really affects their ability to get back together. But at the same time, people can't stop asking about it. They want them to get back together. And, you know, they just keep, all of them are kind of all working on their own stuff.
Right. They do collaborate. And actually, the one album that they all have at least a little bit of a yeah role in is Ringo.
Ringo, yes. Yeah, they're all on that album. Interestingly, the three collaborate, John, Ringo, and George collaborate together quite a bit more than any of them do with Paul.
Right.
I think that Alan Klein thing sort of split them up, and so the three of them end up working together a lot.
But Ringo and Paul stay. Again, Ringo yeah, yeah, just kind of seems to be the most
Ringo's the glue.
Amicable.
Yes. Yeah. Ringo's the glue and is friendly with everyone. The one thing that's also interesting about Imagine, the album, is there's a song called How Do You Sleep On It, which is... You've heard out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's Back to Yesterday.
I mean, it yeah is. Oh, yeah. We talked about it earlier.
Yeah.
It is intense. It's basically an entire... It's a diss track, you know?
Yeah,
I think John Lennon may have invented the diss track with that.
But he is writing it after Paul writes...
Yes. Too Many People.
Too Many People.
So Paul, Too Many People, has two lines about John, right? It says, too many people preaching practices... And then it says, you took your lucky break and you broke it in two.
And that is about John.
That presumably is about John. That yeah is about John. Yeah. John comes back with one of the harshest things you could write about another human being. You know, it's like, the only thing you've done is yesterday. Now you're just another day.
That's not a bad line.
No, not bad at all, especially yeah in both the songs. The sound you make is muzak to my ears. What else is in there?
Baby, how do you sleep when you lie to me? All that shame and all that danger. I'm
wait,
hoping
is this
that
a different song?
Oh, wait. I'm reading How Do You Sleep by Sam Smith. You know what I'm saying? It's also about Paul McCartney. I don't know why he's pissed at Paul McCartney, writing so many years later. All right. Let's get... my bad. How do you sleep? So Sergeant Pepper... took you by surprise. You better see right through the mother's eyes. That mother's eyes. Those freaks was right when they said you was dead. The one mistake you made was in your head. How do you sleep? How do you sleep at night? You live with straights who tell you you was king. Jump when your mama tell you anything. The only thing you done was yesterday. And since you're gone, you're just another day.
By the way, that line about mama is him implying that Paul is whipped by Linda. You know, you jump when you're, what is it? You jump when your mama tells you anything. That's what that is, which is ironic for John to be saying that when, you know, Yoko was.
Seems to be
yeah,
controlling things.
Controlling
yeah
things. So just John later said in later years that the song was kind of more about him than Paul or something like that. But the thing about it is George is on it too.
Yeah.
You know, and it's George is playing this scathing guitar solo. It's like you can there's a documentary Imagine John Lennon, and you see them in the studio working on it together. Clearly, whatever some reason, George held it against Paul, but not against John, and he got back at him.
So then let's go back though to the John George relationship.
Yes.
that changes. So they're both on the Alan Klein side. They're sort of teamed up against Paul. They record How Do You Sleep together, but their relationship gets complicated too.
Yeah, well, it's one thing that starts to happen is George does that concert for Bangladesh, which is very famous and one of the first examples, I think, of rock being used for to raise money for a cause. And he asks John to be a part of it. And John's very excited. John's going to go. They fly to New York to be a part of it. And John sort of assumes that Yoko is going to be a part of it too. But George is like, no, we don't. I don't want Yoko. No, Yoko's not in this.
Yeah.
And John's furious. And John ends up not participating in the concert for Bangladesh because of it. So, you know, there it goes back to this thing. John is very defensive of Yoko and wants her to be seen as an equal to him, you know, as an artist, and wants that recognition for which is cool. It is sweet. There is a sweetness there, but it's to an extreme level. You know, Yoko's not a musician. Like, that's not her primary art form.
Right.
But he wants her on stage with like Dylan and the band. You know, it's crazy. That's the way John saw things at that point. And if he was going to be there, Yoko was going to be there. If Yoko wasn't there, he wasn't going to be there.
And by the end of John's life, well, I mean, no one knew it was going to be the end of John's life. Yeah. George and John are not on good terms.
They're not on good terms. It's not because of this. It's because of something else that happens later on. But they, this, I think, caused a little bit of friction in that moment. And John doesn't participate in that concert. And I think Yoko felt bad about it. And it was just like this upsetting moment for them.
So John releases a few good albums. The album that he releases after Imagine is kind of a flop.
Yeah, you know, that album, I feel like he starts to really, this whole era of John is, he's really getting into like political activism.
Right.
And I think his gift was always, you know, internal poetry, kind of. You know, I think one of his gifts is definitely coming up with a slogan that matches the moment, like, all you need is love, give peace a chance. Like, I do think that was a gift that he had. But I think on this album, it starts to feel a little bit like hectoring. I don't know. It doesn't feel like he's in touch with what made him great.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't also the time that he was dealing with all the immigration issues?
Soon after, okay. He's got the immigration stuff.
Yeah.
And so John wants to be a American citizen.
Yeah.
He loves America.
Yeah.
And he says that New York kind of reminds him of Liverpool and he feels very at home there.
Yeah. He also said that where he wants to be, if he lived in like ancient Roman times, he would want to live in Rome. And he says like New York's the Rome of now.
New York.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I still want to be in New York.
That's a great New York. So he tries to be a citizen and it seems like it goes all the way up to Nixon because he's this troublemaker.
Right. Well, so he had a drug charge in London.
Yes.
And so they were using that against him. And Nixon potentially thought he was a troublemaker. John thought he was being followed at the time and had his phones tapped. And I think he was. Yeah. I think they were kind of keeping an eye on him during this point and spying on him.
And he goes on a series of interviews, one in particular where he brings his lawyer on.
Yeah, yeah.
To talk about all the immigration status things. And eventually he does become an American citizen.
Yes.
The other thing we should talk about mid-70s is what's known as what he calls the lost weekend.
Yeah. This is a fascinating period of time for him because basically what happens is John and Yoko always presented themselves as this couple that are joined at the hip. That was their image. But John was still John. You know, he was still the guy that would get angry and snap, even though Yoko may have had more power in that relationship than Cynthia, he still grew restless and he ended up cheating on her at a party during Nixon's election. They were at someone's house and he ended up like literally going into the room where people like the bedroom where people like put their coats on the bed and having sex with a woman at that party while Yoko was there.
Oh,
and it was like
while people were throwing more
right. People were like, well, I gotta put my coat somewhere. You know, might as well just be on John Lennon and this woman. So he gets drunk too and it becomes this mess. And so Yoko and John decide that they should, you know, spend some time apart. But John is actually like a very insecure person. And he has never done anything alone.
He's been in a relationship for a long, long time.
And not only a relationship, but he's always had like a partner in crime. You know, when he was a kid, it was this guy, Pete Shotton, who was his best friend. And then it became Paul, obviously Cynthia was there at some point, and then it became Yoko. And so now Yoko's like, yeah, get some time alone. But he needed someone else. And so Yoko suggests, hey, there's this assistant of ours at, I guess she like worked at their office or something, named Mei Peng. And he's like, she kind of likes you, right? And you like her. And so Yoko sort of arranges for John to have this like, I guess, assistant / mistress while he goes off without her, while they like break up, I guess, which is really weird.
And I mean, he describes it as The Lost Weekend. It's a reference to the old book / movie where he's definitely drunk and drugged out a lot of the time.
A lot of the time, especially the first chunk of it. You know, he starts hanging out a lot with Harry Nilsson, the singer, who's like a huge mess, and Phil Spector's around. And it's just like he's sort of looked at as a little bit like a fool, you know, like he's being photographed, getting into brawls and arguing. And
he heckles the Smothers Brothers at some stand-up show and gets kicked out.
Yeah, he's just a mess. But he's also getting more productive at this time. So he's starting to work on, I think he puts together Walls and Bridges here during this time period. And eventually, somewhere in the middle of The Lost Weekend, he realizes he has to clean himself up. And he starts doing that. But the other interesting thing that happens is he gets back in touch with his son, Julian, who he sort of abandoned, basically, once he got together with Yoko. John kind of set fire to that relationship too, and he would see Julian from time to time, but not very often. And Julian was like, you know, at this point, I think 13 years old or something, and he was missing his dad and like looked up to him, and his dad was this revered icon who was writing songs about imagine a world, you know, these very profound songs about this beautiful world. And he's kind of like, well, why isn't my dad have any love for me, you know? And sure, I think it was very, very hard for him. And in this period, John starts hanging out with Julian again, and becoming friendly with him and bringing him back into his life. And I think that in some ways, The Lost Weekend starts off so destructively, but it ends up becoming this very healthy period for him. And he even reunites with McCartney again. Mm-hmm. You know, they see each other for the first time since the breakup, and they get along. It's awkward at first, but then they play music together. And weirdly enough, it's McCartney who says something like, you know, I ran into Yoko recently at one of these like Apple Corps meetings that Yoko was doing for John. And she said she's willing to get back together with you. So Paul is kind of mediating now between them. You know, in a lot of interviews you see during this time with John, 1974, he's very relaxed. He's loose. He's very friendly. He talks about being very open to a Beatles reunion. It's really cool. It sort of feels like the time that if the Beatles were going to reunite, it might have happened here.
Right.
Because he's in such a good place.
The inevitable question.
I mean, are they ever going to get back together?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, is there any possibility? But secondly, much more important, do you think that it's a good idea?
Well, that's another point altogether, whether it'd be a good idea or not. You see, it's strange because at one period when they're asking me, I was saying, no, never. What the hell? Go back? No, not me. And then there came to a period when I thought, well, why not? If we felt like making a record or doing something. Now, when I'm saying that, I turn the paper and Georgie say, not me, right? It's never got to a position where each one of us have wanted to do it at the same time. I think over the period of being apart, we've all thought, oh, that wouldn't be nice. That wouldn't be bad, you know. I mean, I've worked with Ringo. I've worked with Ringo and George. I haven't worked with Paul because we had a more difficult time, but now we're pretty close, you know.
But yes, he does get back together with Yoko Ono.
Yes. So one day she calls and says that... interestingly enough, Paul was going to record a new album in New Orleans and said, like, John, do you want to come along with, maybe? And John gets kind of excited and even tells Mei Peng, like, oh, you know, I might write with Paul again. What do you think? She's thrilled. And that, you know, a few days later, Yoko calls and says, I have the cure for cigarette smoking, and I think you're going to love it. And so John's like, all right. And he goes It's like a pop-up ad or something, like some spam email. Right. So he goes with her, kind of vanishes for 3 days, and then comes back to Mei Peng smoking a cigarette. And he's like, that was crazy. By the way, I'm back with Yoko. So, goodbye.
So they get back together. They have a son, Sean Lennon.
Yes.
And before maybe we introduce Sean, I mean, like, it seems like a lot of those relationships that he was improving kind of recede again.
Yeah, they do. You know, I mean, him and Paul are on better terms going forward. They are at least talking. One cool thing also during the last weekend I forgot about is he performs on stage with Elton John. And it's like this huge, he rarely performed live, I think, after the Beatles. And he comes back on stage, the audience goes nuts. And, you know, he plays a number of his songs and he needs to close on something. And so he says something like, we're going to play a song by, I wrote with an old fiance of mine, Paul. And then they play, I Saw Her Standing There, which is great.
Yeah.
It's just really cool.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, mostly a Paul song. So it's even cooler to hear John singing it. But yeah, you know, so I think some of the relationships start to recede with Julian, which is the saddest one of all, I think. It starts to go back a little bit. I think the excuse that Cynthia Lennon gives him, which I think is very generous, is that because Yoko's daughter was taken away from her by her ex-husband, and John and Yoko spent a lot of time looking for her, and they couldn't find her. And so the excuse Cynthia Lennon thinks maybe that because Yoko couldn't see her daughter, that John maybe felt like, well, I'm not going to see my son until you find your daughter.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still just, it's brutal.
And the thing that probably hurts Julian even more is that when Sean is born, John and Yoko's only son, John is like the most devoted father ever.
Yeah, to the point that where John retires from music for a little while. Yeah. And at least to the public says that he is a house husband now. He's going to be a, you know, he's going to be a stay-at-home dad, basically, and that's what's important, and devote himself to Sean fully. Now, like, Cynthia had talked to one of John's sisters, who basically said that John had felt very guilty about the way he treated Julian, and the way he was never there for Julian, and that he was going to do it right this time. But in the process, he was, while making things better for, while doing things over again and doing it well for Sean, he was making it even worse for Julian. And I think he had to have seen that, you know, he's not an idiot, but I don't know. There was just a part of him that couldn't be there for Julian.
And there is an interview from December 8th, 1980.
Yeah.
About a half a day before he's killed.
Yeah.
Where he's talking for a significant amount of time in the interview, he's talking about like his parenting tips.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear John Lennon, you know, very confidently talking about being a dad and making the food. And, you know, he talks a lot about baking bread during this time and just, you know, being there for every bite that Sean had.
I mean, it's a lot about like how people say, I think he says basically like, they'd say that, you know, it's all about quality over quantity, but he's like, no, that's bullshit. It's got to be quantity too. And it's like, Julian's got to be listening to that being like, what the hell?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really jarring how, while being loving to this son, how cruel he is being to his other son.
Writing Beautiful Boy on Double Fantasy.
Yeah. So John eventually does get back into making music. What I do love about this, and I don't know, this probably isn't the only reason he got back into making music, but there's a story that John heard the song Coming Up, McCartney's song Coming Up on the radio. Which is a great song, but John heard it and was like, wait, what is this song? Couldn't tell because Paul's voice is a little disguised on it. And then he said, fuck a pig, that's Paul. And was inspired to get back into the studio.
It is weird that Coming Up was the one. I like Coming Up a lot.
Me too.
But of all of the Paul solo songs, you would think that it would maybe be like, you know, the whole album Band on the Run.
Yeah, like I don't know. He's something about that. Got him.
Coming Up.
Got him. Yeah. So interesting. But I love to believe that even in this period, they still have that power over each other,
right,
you know,
right,
to gin each other on and to like get the other one into the studio and get them to outdo the other one. And I think that especially in the early solo Beatles years, you have to still credit the Beatles umbrella for the greatness of the early albums. Because first of all, a lot of the songs, a lot of All Things Must Pass, a lot of Ram, a lot of Imagine were made up of songs that they had been working on during their time as Beatles.
Right.
And even if they'd rejected the songs, even if they hadn't worked on them together, I think just having to just George having to know I'm going to present this song to John and Paul, or just John knowing I'm going to have to bring this song to the Beatles. I think that stuff that made those albums as good as they are. You still have that Beatles magic in there, even if they're not working on them together. And I just think that's cool. At the very end of John's career, he's still, what maybe pulled him back was this thing from Paul.
And I actually think that Double Fantasy, which is the album that comes out just weeks before John is killed, might be his best post-Beatles album.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I do like it a lot.
I guess Mind Games is great.
Mind Games is good. I like Walls and Bridges. I like Imagine a lot.
Imagine's great.
Imagine's a little, like, the production is a little, I don't know, it feels a little samey after a certain point. There's like this like ethereal sound that I get kind of tired of.
And Phil Spector is a big part of those early albums.
Yeah, right.
And then they also kind of split a little bit.
Yeah, because Phil Spector's insane and ends up murdering someone.
Yeah, no, that's a problem. So John Lennon's death.
Yeah, yeah. December 8th, 1980. Which is interesting because there's some very famous photos taken that same day, that very famous Annie Leibovitz photo of John naked on top of Yoko was taken that same day of his death, which is very eerie.
Mark David Chapman.
Right.
Was a rabid Beatles fan.
Yep.
And one of the things that made him turn on the Beatles was the Jesus quote from so many years ago.
Yeah, one of the things.
One of the things.
Yeah.
The other thing, famously, he was inspired by Catcher in the Rye, and he saw this as a, you know, that John Lennon was a phony, right? That he had to kill phonies.
That he's right. He's talking about Imagine a World Without Possessions. He lives in this beautiful mansion, you know, in the Dakota, or this beautiful apartment. And, you know, he was just a crazy person. You know, I think he's given him many, many reasons over the years. He had other people on his list to kill that included Jackie Kennedy. I think McCartney was one of them.
No.
So, you know, I think the thing about this killing and in this moment, what makes it so shocking is that there really isn't a reason. You know, it's because he's famous. I think ultimately it was John Lennon was famous.
Yeah.
And this guy, a fan, killed him.
And accessible.
I mean,
he was, you know, would walk around and
It
was, I mean, he sees Lennon earlier in the day, gets an autograph from
him.
Which
is crazy. Yeah.
And then,
There's a photo of the two of them together.
And then John Lennon goes about his day. And when he comes home that night, he gets shot.
Yeah. Four times in the back. And yeah, basically, I think he had hollow point bullets. And he was killed immediately.
Yoko Ono arranges it so that there is 10 minutes of silence in his honor, or dedicated to world peace. Yeah. And there was some music that was still ready to be produced and that they whip up together. Milk and Honey?
Milk and Honey, yeah, I think that's right.
Is the album that comes out a few years after his death.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, in the aftermath of his death, he becomes this martyr and this saint. And first of all, it's very shocking to people, I think, because it's just, I think he was the most famous of the Beatles, and I can't really think of another thing like it in history, like an equivalent, you know, but usually when obviously a lot of people were shot in the 60s, but it's politicians, civil rights leaders. In this case, it really feels like this entertainer is just gunned down for no reason. And it's very shocking. I mean, you know, obviously John Lennon had things to say. He was more than just a pop star. But in some ways, I think that the senselessness of it adds to why people were so shocked and why it still feels sort of jarring to know that it happened.
Right. And then you, of course, go back to the old interviews and you go back to songs and stuff. And you see what you mentioned at the beginning where it's like, you know, little things that, or you said that day he was given the interview and he had some sort of what seems like premonition.
I mean, yeah, it's just, it's there. You're saying like maybe there's some clues kind of laid in.
No,
it.
I just
like that are kind of eerie. Like when he's in Come Together, he says, shoot me.
Yeah.
Happiness is a warm gun.
Happiness is a warm gun. Yeah. Sure.
Life is very short, you know, and we can work it out. You know, there's some, there's some eerie lines that he has.
So just to geek out on Lennon for a second, I mean, but we've been doing it for a while, but favorites, how about favorite Beatles stuff?
Okay. In My Life, we've said already, one of the best. I really do love Come Together. I know it's a little cliche, but it's just, it's such a great song.
Yeah.
Strawberry Fields, I think, one of the best Beatles songs. I feel like I'm just going through all the complete basic cliche answers, but...
No, but I mean,
I just don't know. I'm Only Sleeping is such a great song.
Yeah.
What about you? Any others?
No, I mean, Happiness is a Warm Gun is a big one.
It's great,
for me.
Yeah.
I think that that's, I mean, obviously a very famous song, but underappreciated. Across the Universe, I never fully got.
I like it.
Is that Lennon?
Yeah, it's Lennon.
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. No, it is. Or now I, you know. I love it. No, it's great. I mean, it is one of those things where if I say a less good Beatles song, it's
still,
I mean, it's crazy to look at lists of the top 100 Beatles songs and think of the songs that are not even on the list.
It's insane.
Obla Di Obla Da is like rarely on these top 100 lists.
Yeah.
And like plenty of bands. I mean, I'm not saying it's an amazing song.
Of course. Yeah.
And post Beatles?
I love, what do I love from him post Beatles? I love Out the Blue.
Yeah, that song's Mind amazing. Games. You turned me on to that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great song. I love Woman.
Yeah.
Beautiful Boy, which is a heartbreaking song to listen to. You know, it's a song he wrote for his son, Sean, and it's just sad. He's talking about watching him get old. He can't wait to watch him get older. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure it reads very differently than how he intended it.
Right.
So it's a sad song, but I like that one. What else do I like?
I'm a big Jealous Guy fan.
Jealous Guy is great. Yeah. Great song.
The other thing that I guess I want to ask is like the Beatles. I mean, there are more documentaries, books, all this stuff. You said to me that like one of the reasons why you were maybe holding back from choosing Lennon is because there's just already so much stuff.
So
about
much
the Beatles.
Stuff, yeah.
But what do you think it is? I mean, other than the fact that it's so much great music in relatively a short amount of time, but like, I mean, this thing is talked about, the Beatles and their legacy is talked about almost as much as any other subject.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. I think it's because they were more than just a band that put out good records.
Yeah.
You know, they were a cultural force. And we talked so many times about how they defined the waves of the 60s. And I just don't think Beatlemania, before or since, there's nothing really that compares to that level of worldwide adulation, even though I'm sure more people listen to a Taylor Swift song now than they listen to a Beatles song just volume wise. I just think that that moment that they so clearly dominated was singular
and developed. I mean, like,
yeah,
I said relatively short amount of time, but I kind of take it back because it's like 8 to 10 years, or you know, whenever you mark the beginning of when they're really starting to get big, that's a long time to be number one.
Yeah.
And to be number one in different ways. And I mean, there's to go from I Saw Her Standing There, which is an amazing song, to the Abbey Road medley,
takes
a crazy amount of openness to evolve and to constantly reinvent yourself.
Yeah, that was what was great about them, the constant reinvention and never being set in, well, we do this, this is doing well, let's just do another one. You know, they easily could have done that. They were at the top right away, right after Please Please Me. It was huge. They could have just said, let's just put out like 8 Please Please Me's, you know, just keep going, keep the machine going. But they kept evolving. And that is, it's unbelievable. That took all of them to get in there and work and probably not enjoy the fame that much. You know, I'm sure they did enjoy the fame. I'm sure they had some great moments, but it seems like they toured. It was miserable. It was hard. they had some good times, and then they were back in the studio working. And it's just like incredible, an incredible work ethic.
And you probably do, as upsetting as it is for any Beatles fan that they broke up, and particularly that they broke up in a sort of
acrimonious
way. Yeah. You know, maybe there wasn't anything left in the tank, or at least there wasn't any new
direction
type.
Yeah,
thing.
I think based on their first round of solo albums, they probably could have done another really awesome
combine,
album.
Yeah,
you know, like the best of Plastic Ono Band, Imagine, Ram, McCartney, and All Things Must Pass. And did Ringo have? Ringo was later, right? The solo Ringo,
the big, yeah, right,
was a little bit later, but like, there was plenty of good, amazing material.
Right.
But they would have been met with diminishing returns at some point. And the 60s maybe was their era, and it was time to go out on top. Yeah, I mean, so that's what I think.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very, I think, special return for the podcast just because this is an epic, epic episode. But yeah. I think about a guy who deserves...
Yeah, an interesting guy.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right, man. Thanks. You.
Thanks.